I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, uncertainty and a certain sense of dread, even paranoia, fills the air as coronavirus grips not only the United States, but the world at large. Joining us on this edition of the program is a regular guest that's no stranger to Parallax Views. I'm talking about the great gumshoe journalist, J.P. Sitilli, otherwise known as the News Vandal, to discuss not only the coronavirus pandemic, but also current events, specifically the 2020 elections, the rise of Joe Biden, now being called by some the comeback kid, and of course the Bernie Sanders campaign, and with it the state of the progressive and left-wing movements politically in America. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views. Somber times, so I'm not gonna try to sell you on the conversation much more. I think we should just jump right into it. Here it is. J.P. Sitilli, the News Vandal. Welcome back to Parallax Views. J.P. Sitilli, the News Vandal. How are you doing, J.P.?
I have cabin fever. I've been on self-quarantine for 2 weeks, and because my best friend and roommate has it, and two people came into her workplace, and they came in from Asia, and they were sick, and so people started to self-quarantine, and so I'm right in the middle of the experience, because this is an experience, right? This is a collective global experience, is one of the things that makes this unique.
I did not realize that you were that close to this whole coronavirus thing.
Well, I'm also in Northern California, and I live on the island of Alameda, which is right sort of dead center of all of the different epicenters in Santa Clara County. Now we have one happening a little bit in San Francisco. There's one in the North Bay. So we're kind of in the – and then, of course, Oakland is really like a 5-minute drive for me, where the giant cruise ship has been docked, offloading patients. So the Bay Area has been sort of a center for this, in no small part because of its – place in the globalized economy. and relative to Asia in particular with technology.
That's interesting you mentioned the globalized economy. I'm seeing a lot of op-eds coming out saying, will coronavirus be the end of globalization? I think there was just an op-ed with that exact title by John Pfeffer at Foreign Policy and Focus, and I've had a few people suggest that things like coronavirus are going to bring about a... Well, I mean, we're already in a resurgence of nationalism, not just in the U.S., but globally, and I kind of worry that this is going to maybe accelerate that.
I think that that is the most interesting question right now. As a matter of fact, before we came on the air this morning, or you brought me onto your podcast, we're not on the air. Sorry about that, JG. I'm just old habits. I postulated a question on social media. This is the COVID-19 choose your own adventure novel virus. And is it going to be the common good or every person for themselves? And I think that this is one of those fundamental philosophical questions that everybody is dealing with. And it's actually been leading up to this. If I can digress for a second, I think that this is a Malthusian issue. This is an environmental issue. I think nature is constantly fighting back against mankind's voraciousness and indifference to ecological balance. And to me, that's the natural law system that we find ourselves in when populations expand exponentially and they encroach on ecosystems. Ecosystems tend to bite back. And in a larger sense, I think that when you look at nationalism around the world, there is a subconscious rationale that drives nationalism in an age of spiking temperatures and climate change. I think that fundamentally, subconsciously, the collective unconscious, if you will, understands that we are heading into a time of ecological peril. And there are two ways to do it. You can deal with it. One is to deal with it through increased cooperation, or one is to build walls, put guns and parapets in place, and arm people and try and keep all the other people out while you protect your larder. And I think Trump phenomenon is a reflection of the protect your larder survivalist mentality, which is part of the larger nationalist mentality that I think is sweeping around the nation, around the globe.
It was interesting. I was on the American Conservative website yesterday browsing it, and I noticed, lo and behold, Pat Buchanan has an op-ed out saying, see, we were right about immigration, and this is going to be the death of the New World Order and globalization. So there were some people saying to me, oh, maybe he took it from that John Pfeffer article, the Will This Kill Globalization article. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure Buchanan thought this, and you know, his eyes were just lighting up as soon as this happened.
I actually used that as the final story in my Leeds thread on Friday. And that story came out on Thursday. I don't know when Pfeffer's story came out. I did see it come across the transom maybe yesterday. So they may have been writing at almost coterminously. But
I think it came out on March 12th, actually, the Pfeffer one.
Oh, the Pfeffer one.
I'm sure Buchanan – I'm sure that the gears were turning in Buchanan's head.
Oh, yeah. No, this is – Buchanan has been saying this since 1991. I mean, this is, you know, fits right into the argument. And it also fits into a lot of other neatly fits into a lot of other conservative arguments, like Tom Cotton's incredible Sinophobia and the Sinophobia of Bill Gertz, who is now back at Washington Times. People who are writing calling this the Chinese virus, the Wuhan virus. Donald Trump always opens up his comments by saying this virus that came to us from China, or that China started. And the idea that this is a bioweapon that China has unleashed on the world and all of that. So all of those sort of paranoid fever dreams are definitely being fed by this. And so the question is, it's really fascinating because De Welt, yesterday broke a story, and they claim to have they have sources that claim that the Trump administration was trying to buy away scientists from a company called CureVac, a German company that's working on a vaccine for coronavirus. And because the United States capabilities in developing vaccines are lagging, the story goes that Trump was basically trying to bribe away scientists or the company itself to come to the United States and bring it exclusively to the United States. And now you have the German government, members in the German government and the Bundestag pushing back and saying, no, 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 we need to keep this here. Get out of our research industry, America. And one German politician, I think, said any vaccine has to be all for the world, not just for America. So this is a fundamental decision point for humanity in many ways. And this is with the backdrop of climate change accelerating. I mean, the hockey stick is spiking. And, you know, it was just confirmed that we had the five hottest years on record. Winter basically disappeared from Moscow this year. Anecdotally, anybody on the East Coast that I've talked to has said we didn't really get winter this year. And there are things like the locust plague that happened in North Africa, which is being linked to climate change because of changes happening resulted to that. And, you know, everything that's happening now is really an outgrowth of this global ecological catastrophe, putting restrictions on what human beings are going to be able to do in the future, and all of us knowing that. But how we deal with it, this is the question of our time.
Well, it seems like in some ways we may not be dealing with it that well right now. I mean, I know a lot of people that were complaining yesterday saying, oh, they had to ruin everything by saying we can't go to the bars on St. Paddy's Day weekend, and oh, they've shut down our basketball games. I've seen people complaining about that kind of stuff, and I'm like, I don't think you guys are taking this very seriously.
Well, JG, don't you think that's also an outgrowth? Because this is a fascinating dividing line.
I'll tell you what I think it is. I think in America there's this attitude of like rugged individualist masculinity where you can show no fear, even if it's a virus that doesn't really care if you're afraid or not and will kill you.
Right. American exceptionalism, I've always said, really comes down to one thing. Everybody except me. That's what really at its base level American exceptionalism is. On the international scale, you follow all of these laws except us. That's what exceptionalism is. So for this rugged individualism you're talking about, you know, everybody's, you know, going to succumb to this except me. I think there's another interesting subtext here, though, and it's related to the election. And I think we're in a moment of incredible intergenerational angst.
That's very true.
The dividing line, I think you can almost put it into the dividing line between Biden and Bernie, right? I think a lot of the people under 40 who are calling coronavirus the boomer remover and who are they're kind of channeling their disappointment about their inability to elect their own candidate or to nominate their own candidate or for their votes to count in an environment in which the old people who are over 40 voted much higher proportion. That this is an outgrowth of that. It's a way of expressing it, right? No,
I'm
young.
Can I ask you a question real quickly here?
Yeah.
In that regard, I know people have complained about low voter turnout for the youth and saying that's why Bernie has been hit really hard. I've heard other people saying that a lot of this is just due to boomers in sheer numbers, and this is in their name, baby boomers.
Right.
Are such a massive part of the population, even to this day, that they can just outnumber everyone. I mean, they have a lot of power just based on their sheer numbers.
Sheer demographic numbers. But oddly enough, I think both of those things are actually true. So in Virginia and Texas, there was an increase in the aggregate numbers, in the just the raw data numbers of young people voting, and there was a larger proportion of older people voting that offset that, so that that didn't have the impact. So there is that. There are those two things at play, but still, they're not voting. You're not getting 60 or 70% of young people voting. So still, they could, if there was still a larger percentage of young people coming out to vote, it could actually mitigate the impact of the larger numbers of the boomers. And this is, you know, the thing is this is not new, and this is, it's not like anybody should be blaming 18 to 25 or 18 to 29 year olds for not coming out in a greater proportion, that 70% of them don't. It is absolutely true with every generation. It's like a generational ladder, that as each generation climbs up the ladder and the person and the group at the top of the ladder finally leaves the ladder to vacate the top rung for the next generation, the proportion, the percentage of that population that votes increases every time the ladder changes rungs. It just, and I think that it's part of the design of the American system. The way I look at it is as generations become more vested financially in property, the interest they have in voting increases, the self-interest they have in voting increases. And if you think about it, that's the fundamental design of the American Republic, is that white landowning individuals were given the right to vote and everybody without property was not. And it was tied to property. And this, the system itself, I think, is almost psychologically built to inspire people to vote to protect their private property, not to engage in the common good. Now, this has been a push and pull in American society, right? We've had periods where the common good has been important, like the Great Depression. And what did that lead to? That led to FDR. There was a sort of a spike in the idea of the common good at the end of the Eisenhower years. And then that led to the 60s. And then you had the backlash to that. And then you had Nixon and then Reagan. And we are still, I think, in the backlash to the idea of the common good as a rationale for voting. And the rationale for voting is to protect your private property, your property rights, and your individual rights. And I think I think as Generation Z in particular is starting to blossom, we're seeing that there is a motivation to vote in favor of the common good over the individual. And unfortunately, the baby boomers and my generation, Generation X, which I think has been mixed and maybe I would personally say disappointing. I think a lot of my generation that, you know, I grew up in the punk new wave scene and whatnot, and I'm amazed at how many of particularly the skate punks and the punk movement, a lot of them ended up becoming conservative because there was actually that skinhead movement in there. And I think my generation is mixed. I think millennials we haven't figured out where they're going to come down yet. I happen to have a millennial. He's, 26 now. He's married. But millennials have not been able to buy into the society yet because of all of the financial constraints that have been placed on, particularly with education and student loans. So
I was going to add really quickly, it's interesting you mentioned the Gen X thing, because some people get really aggravated when I say, overall, there's still more people from Gen X that sort of got through okay since maybe 08 than there are millennials and Generation Z. And that can be a very touchy subject.
Well, I don't know about that, because I think there are some, but I have to tell you, when I look at a Trump rally, what I see in the background are a lot of Gen Xers, a lot of my generation. Those crowds, it's not just boomers. There are a lot of people in their late 40s.
A lot of Gen X are already in their 50s.
Yes, and in their 50s. And so, are you going to make me tell everybody how old I am? Anyway, I was actually born sort of at the very beginning of Gen X, 1969, I was born within a month of Altamont here in Northern California, which, you know, of course, that's the, I think the great, it's either a combination, it's some combination of the Manson killings and Altamont being sort of the punctuation at the end of the 60s, right? That the 60s are over, baby. When the Hell's Angels are taking pull cues to people at a big festival concert, you know it's over. I think that a lot of my generation is actually incredibly insecure financially, and I think that that's one of the things that drives their support for Donald Trump. And I don't buy into the whole economic insecurity issue with Donald Trump as being the primary driver. I think a lot of it is actually there are culture war issues there and others, but I think that that's part of the self-interest that drives a lot of support for Donald Trump among baby boomers. And I think that there's also sort of a reactionary aspect and strain in the Gen X generation, because we're the last generation to actually see what the American dream looked like. We saw it growing up on the television shows we watched in the afternoons and reruns. We saw it reflected in the popular culture. We saw it with some of us, you know, had baby boomers as parents. I did not. My parents were born before World War II, so they were part of a different generation that had known on some level at least the immediate echo of the Great Depression and going through World War II. My father was an immigrant from Italy who was in Sicily, and he remembered bombing and all that. So maybe my frame of reference is not quite the same, but, you know, a lot of my peers were the first set of kids that the baby boomers had, maybe products of Summer of Love kind of stuff. And I think that there is also a resentment that the taste of the American dream that was still available in the late 70s and maybe even at the very beginning of the early 80s when the big shift happened, because I think the election of Reagan is a major dividing line in American history, recent American history, that there's this reactionary resentment. And if you look at what the 80s was, the 80s really was a neo sort of 50s throwback. We got Ronald Reagan, host of GE Theater, Mr. Brill Cream, you know, coming in, and everybody said, hey, let's put the women in big shoulder pads and high heels again. Let's get rid of that whole ERA thing that was just about on the verge of passing as we entered the 80s. Let's, instead of prioritizing, you know, braless feminists, let's replace them with Linda Evans and Joan Collins and Dynasty, let's bring back pointy bras, and let's get reactionary. Let's try and have a throwback period. And that's what the 80s was. And we've been in that reaction ever since. And I think Donald Trump is actually the culmination of a process that began with the election of Ronald Reagan. And I think for a lot of my generation, where there was a dividing line in the 80s itself between those of us who were kind of the freaks and geeks and the square pegs and whatnot versus the jocks, which is one of those, you know, it's not unusual that we continue, our generation continues to celebrate our teenage years, and why John Hughes films are still very wildly popular with my generation, because I think we are still in that perpetual dividing line of our adolescence where we're trying to figure out how we're going to navigate this world in which the American dream is no longer available to us.
Maybe I spoke too soon about Gen X there. I don't know. I think a lot of people in my age bracket are just very angry with older generations. And as I've been telling people, it's not really without reason. I mean,
agreed.
I mean, it seems like it's the younger people that are wanting things like Medicare for All. I'm not sure the boomer demographic wants that. And, you know, it's going to be the younger generation that is going to be paying the burden of the health costs for the older generation, and likely not even going to see things like homeownership in their lifetime because they're weighed down by student loan debt. And, you know, I think that anger is really starting to show right now.
Agreed, and I think that they have every right to be angry, and I would say that not seeing homeownership is sort of the least of the issues. I think ecological collapse is really is going to be the overarching story of this century. And, you know, if your listeners are not familiar, I do this thing called the Rundown. And every day I get up, I've been doing this for 10 years, 5 days a week. I get up at 4 and I start pulling stories, and I pull about 30 pages of links, and it's just the headline and the web address, the HTML, the HTTP address, excuse me, and the URL. And I sort through them, and I have categories, and I pull a lot of environmental stuff. So I've had this really unique sort of vantage point over the last 10 years to see how headlines have changed over time. And I basically get to watch stories develop over the years because I keep going back to – I have like maybe 300 or 400 environmental science sources that I go to regularly over the course of a week or two. Every 2 weeks I cycle through all the links. And all the websites. And what I am seeing over the last 3 or 4 years is a rapid acceleration in the dire reporting on ecological collapse on a number of levels. Fisheries, the loss of soil, of capacity in soil, the acidification of oceans and coral reefs, rapid declines in animal populations, in insect populations, in bird populations, in pollinator populations, the inability of plants and animals to adjust to rapidly changing and ecological and temperature environments. The carrying capacity of the planet is shrinking, even as the number of human beings is growing. That is a bad equation for the next four to five decades. And I think, you know, when you look at Greta and the Extinction Rebellion movement and the New Green Deal and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez leading the New Green Deal and this generational divide, I think it is completely rational for young people to be not just perturbed but angry about the consumption addiction of the older generations and the indifference that older generations have to the plight that is being being framed for younger generations.
Do you think there's a little bit of cruel irony that this is happening, this whole coronavirus thing, this pandemic, is happening right after, you know, it's basically becoming clear that Bernie really doesn't have a path forward in the election? And I know some people get mad at me for saying that. I know a lot of Bernie or bust people, and I understand where they're coming from to some extent and why they're angry about things. But there's a sort of cruel irony in this because coronavirus comes right after Bernie starts lagging behind, and he's the one pushing for Medicare for all. And boomers that didn't want Medicare for all, apparently.
Exactly. Well, it's ironic on so many levels. I literally was just commenting on this in a DM with somebody that had this coronavirus thing hit like this 2 months ago, Bernie would have had a daily hook to make his case. a daily hook. I mean, the entire zeitgeist of the news cycle would have been a framework for him to build his case. I think, unfortunately, it's come too late, right? It's come too late in terms of delegate count and the dynamics of the election itself, but also because this now affords Joe Biden an opportunity to make his primary argument, which is a juxtaposition against the cruelty of Donald Trump.
The return to normal.
The return to normal. This is an environment where I think a lot of people are going to say, now I really want to return to normal, even if that is a pipe dream, which I think a lot of young people would say it is a pipe dream, not just because returning to normal is returning to something that wasn't good in the first place, but is it even possible to return to normal after this? And so I think on those two counts, those are both two very, very logical and viable arguments to make. But one of the things that I think that a lot of young people and a lot of Bernie supporters have failed to understand about the American electorate is that logic is not the primary motivating factor for voting in American life. It just isn't.
Well, neither are issues. Maybe in a way, I wonder if I was too quick to say, oh, all boomers hate Medicare for All, or they voted against it. Because the thing is, a lot of Bernie's ideas are, to my understanding, really, really popular. But people don't vote on issues. They don't vote on a Medicare for All.
Nope.
And my understanding, too, is that this is actually a long-running issue, because people have wanted a better healthcare system for years, to my understanding, and Medicare for All and things like it are very popular, but it's not what people are voting on.
Nope. Think about the 2000 election, and if you want to talk about a fork in the road in retrospect, that was an election that was Al Gore, guy who wrote a book called Earth in the Balance in 91, was it? 92? And then becomes famous for An Inconvenient Truth. And George W. Bush, the son of basically the entire oil and military industrial complex. He is like the child of that world. And in that election, the United States made a choice based – let's put aside the stealing of the election in Florida and the fact that actually Al Gore really won. But
he also won the popular vote, regardless of the hanging chads.
But the fact that it was not a wipeout election of George W. Bush, and the fact that George W. Bush had a path to steal the election, let's put it that way, right? Because if you're going to steal the election in the United States, you actually have to get close enough to have a path to do it, to use the Electoral College to your advantage. The fact that people voted for George W. Bush, and this is – I know it's almost like a cliche, but it actually is true, because he's a guy you would want to have a beard with versus a wooden – that's how Al Gore was framed. He was wooden and stentorian and a guy you didn't want lecturing you for the next 4 years. And if I look back at American elections in my lifetime, they've almost always, without fail, been won based on feelings and not issues. Feelings. Ronald Reagan was like, "We're tired of being kicked around. We want you know, the America of our youth back again. We want to be proud to be an American where at least I believe or think I'm free. At least I've been told I'm free." Those emotional appeals, and I think that one of the misreadings of Bernie Sanders' campaign is that the revolutionary zeal, which I think was a feeling that was palpable in 2016, is not the predominant feeling people are responding to in 2020. And so that revolutionary zeal now becomes toxic in an environment in which it would have been rewarded. Because I think people are looking for, as you said, a return to normal. They want calm. I've wrote this a number of times, and it's my mantra that the single most important factor heading into 2020 is Trump fatigue syndrome, is people saying, I just want him to go away. I don't want to tweet every morning that invades my headspace. I don't want to turn on the TV and have everything be about him. I want to go back to my life. I want to be able to go somewhere and not have to worry about saying the right or wrong thing about Trump or anything. They just want their headspace back. So the issues have become secondary, and that's where, in a sense, Biden is almost perfect because he is an empty vessel. I mean, I made a comment on Chuck O'Shelley's show that an old shoe should be able to beat Donald Trump in a 1-1 matchup. And in a way, that's what the Democrats are on their way to nominating, an old shoe. Just, you know what the old shoe is, you know how it looks, you know how it fits, you know how it feels, and you really don't care what foot is in the old shoe. You just want the old shoe because you want comfort.
It's interesting. I've been reading Branko Marcetek's new book, The Case Against Joe Biden. Branko writes, I believe, for Jacobin.
Yes. Yep.
And that book is, like, really, really revealing because it's not even that Biden necessarily comes off as right wing, although he's aligned with the right on a lot of things. I just don't know that he believes in anything.
Right. Right. It's frustrating for people who believe in things and who have policy agendas to be losing to somebody who is an empty urn that people can pour their own whatever into and carry it around. So this is back to the generational divide. I think because we have this competition between every person for themselves and individual aggrandization versus the common good, and we are still in what would be, so from 1980 to now, a 40-year period of prioritizing the individual over the common good. For young people who have identified for themselves a candidate who is a throwback to a time when their battle between the common good and the individual was being waged outside the Democratic Convention in 1968. I mean, that's the irony, right? Is that Bernie Sanders is a relic or a lone sort of flag bearer for a baby boomer ethos of the 60s that the baby boomers themselves abandoned in 1980 to vote for Ronald Reagan. I mean, it's really kind of operatic in a way to see how this is all playing out right now. But I think, unfortunately, until the top rung of the ladder is vacated, and then my generation, the generation that I think is not prepared for in any way, shape, or form for retirement, has to get up there and then starts to maybe see that their self-interest is not being reflected by their desire or by their angst over the fact that they're not going to be able to replicate what the baby boomers had. Until that happens and then millennials move into the Gen X rung and they start voting in much greater numbers, and then Gen Z starts voting in the numbers that millennials do, I think that the every person for themselves ethos is going to continue to dominate. And that ethos is one in which I think arguments that are predicated on evoking emotional responses and not logical policy prescriptions is going to continue to dominate.
With regards to Joe Biden, it's been interesting. I see a lot of Bernie supporters and progressives that keep pushing on this narrative of he has cognitive decline, or if they're feeling really not tactful, they'll say dementia. And I've kind of avoided that because, to be quite frank, ever since I've seen Joe Biden and known about him, he's kind of like a Democratic George Bush in that he's this, like, aw shucks character that kind of says ridiculous and nonsensical things in this, like, folksy manner, and it's like, haha, he's like one of the, you know, yokels that says odd things every once in a while. Like, I think that's part of his, like, whole persona, basically.
Look, one of the things that helped George W. Bush get elected, and I think it was a setup by Karl Rove. I don't know if you remember this. Early in the campaign, before even the Iowa, New Hampshire caucuses and primary, he was in an interview and he was ambushed. Can you name the leader of Kazakhstan? Can you name the leader? And he couldn't. And everybody thought, oh, see, look, he's not qualified. But that's not the message there. The message was, see, he's not some elite, educated guy. We are going to unplug his biography in which he goes to Yale from him and excise him from the educated liberal elite of Yale and the Northeast, just like his father had to be unplugged to run in Texas, right? Because I always had this funny image of George Herbert Walker Bush with his feet up wearing topsiders with no socks on, right, and a pair of khakis eating pork rinds, because that was what his father had to do, had to somehow eat pork rinds even though he was part of the Northeastern establishment. And so creating that kind of folksy, you know, image is something that Donald Trump did. Why was Donald Trump taking pictures of himself on his own plane? He had his own plane, his own jet, but he's sitting there with his thumbs up eating McDonald's. Why? Is it just because he's a fast food junkie, or because he's signaling to people, look, I'm one of you. I'm one of you.
Well, that's why people are surprised when Biden says something to someone like, you want to take this out back? I'll kick your ass.
Right.
He's doing that on purpose.
Yes, it's
because
brilliant.
It's an anti-elitism thing. Like, look, exactly. I'm one of the normal folks, the everyday common Joes.
That's right. And watching the blatherati, the political blatherati say, oh, how could he do this? And he's blundering. And watching Bernie supporters say, see, you really want this guy? This is the guy you're choosing? Yeah, because that's – I mean, I hate to say it, but there is a – this is the electorate we have.
Well, you know, in a way, I kind of wonder – there was a recent article that came out. Let me see if I can pull it up right now. The week Bernie Sanders realized he was losing the primary,
yes,
BuzzFeed News.
Yeah.
You know, that was an odd article because I thought that was the most humanizing thing I have ever read about Bernie Sanders.
Yes.
Like, he seems like a person that – after reading that, I think he's someone that really believed in what he was doing.
Yes.
Even if there were mistakes made. But it was interesting because I know some people in the campaign were like, why can't you just go harder on Biden? And he won't do it because he considers Biden a friend.
And you know who else had that same issue? Was Dukakis. Dukakis is – people were saying go harder at George Herbert Walker Bush. And Dukakis says, I don't want to run that campaign. Now, it's different than him having Biden as a friend. But I also think Bernie – in that, what came across to me in that article was that Bernie wants to win on what he believes in, and he doesn't want to modulate. And I saw that even Matt Taibbi, and I think this would have been March 6th that the article came out? Maybe it was the day after Super Tuesday, that he even said that Bernie Sanders needs to make some adjustments and modulations to his message to adjust. Because you have to expand and reach out and maybe make some compromises in terms of just your messaging to bring more people in. You know, James Clyburn was asked, why didn't you give Bernie Sanders your endorsement? And Clyburn said, because he didn't ask me. And so I think Bernie Sanders is believes so strongly in what he is doing that it actually – his commitment to his ideas, which is admirable, is also his limitation. And I think this is one of the unfortunate parts, I guess, for people who are true believers in policy ideas and big ideas, is that is that the American system is designed to tamp down that. It's designed to punish that. And you are rewarded for occasionally or repeatedly compromising your ideals to try and expand your base to those who don't necessarily agree with you on everything. It's kind of the way the system is set up. And, you know, I think if his, like, for if his Medicare for All thing had been modulated early on, even if he had said that this is going to be what I'm planning on is implementing this over the course of 8 years, not a sudden shock to the system, but a slow evolution to the system, it may have seemed less revolutionary to people, and people may have gotten more in touch with him as a person, as a figure, and not as somebody who is a front person for a radical policy agenda. Because as you've said a number of times in this conversation, and which I think is absolutely true, is that issues and policies are not the driver, it's the personality. And so I think his person, if I was running his campaign, I would be running him as the ultimate mensch, the man who wants us all to take care of each other. And that is a different thing than running a policy agenda.
It keeps surprising me that I was talking to Harvey Kay about this, who's a professor that just wrote a book called Take Hold of Our History, Make America Radical Again. And he has said that the campaign should be sort of crafting a narrative about how Bernie has a lot in common with, say, an FDR, and yes, this sort of tradition, yep, of taking care of each other. And when I talked to Harvey a few days ago about this, he said he was actually kind of angry at the Bernie campaign in a way for not pushing on that, not saying, you know, we are from a tradition of people like FDR and Tom Paine. And the fact that Bernie hasn't done that, in a way I can see why people would say, why didn't he? You know, because I think there's a lot you can use in the sort of narrative of the American tradition and its history that you can find in Bernie Sanders. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I think one of the oddities of the Democratic Party is that its greatest hero is not available to it anymore, and that would be FDR. And you know, I look at Reagan's election as the final, or as the beginning, not the beginning of the end, because really Nixon in some ways is, but Nixon is an odd bird in Republican politics, because it's really Reagan is the beginning of the complete abandonment of FDR's tradition, or FDR's version of America, which I call a demand side form of capitalism as opposed to a supply side form of capitalism. Let's prioritize putting money and capital in the hands of the demand side of the economy, not the supply side, in the workers, consumer side of the economy, not the producer financial side of the economy. So to me the real nail in the coffin of FDR as a architect of a version of America that actually produced the American dream that my generation got a taste of and watched die before its eyes, is that's the American dream is actually FDR's America. So it's kind of funny. At least the American dream that blossomed in the 50s and early 60s. So the nail in the coffin comes, and I believe it was 96, that Bill Clinton gave it was either 96 or 98, I'm sorry, I think it's 96, gave the famous State of the Union speech in which he said the era of big government is over. And Bill Clinton was the guy who made sure, or ensured, is probably a better way of putting it, ensured that FDR was no longer available as a hero to the Democratic Party, as one of its saints. Much as Reagan is the patron saint of the Republican Party, FDR should be the patron saint of the Democratic Party. And no small part because Reagan, his sainthood was predicated on destroying FDR's version of America. That's the duel. And that's the duel between the individual and the common good that we've been talking about in this entire podcast. And I do think it's an incredible – it's incredibly unfortunate in terms of politics, in terms of politicking, that FDR is not there. But, you know, most people now don't even really know about FDR's America and what happened in FDR's America.
I think the feeling is still there, though. I think when you learn about FDR in school, I think people know – that he's considered like the great president of the 20th century.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm wrong about that. I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's hard for me because I grew up with people, even for my immigrant father, these are people who all lionized FDR. And there was a time in America where you know, many, many households had a picture of FDR in the living room or over the kitchen table. I mean, the level of FDR's the love for FDR in American life is unparalleled and in the last 100 years, and for sure. And excising that was really what the conservative agenda that was born in the late 40s and early 50s that gave birth to everything we think of when we think of right-wing conservatism, you know, from Kirk to Buckley all the way through to the Reagan Revolution. And, you know, in my state, it was, you know, Jarvis Gann initiative and then Phyllis Schlafly and the Eagle Forum and all of these things, the culture wars, the rise of Falwell's version of evangelicalism and how that was part of in a milieu that developed eventually into the prosperity gospel, which is merged with this right-wing conservatism in the Trump administration. All of this is part of a war against that idea of FDR's idea of the common good. And
it's funny. I was just going to say really briefly, it's funny you mentioned Schlafly. I've been thinking about her lately. You know, it seems like, I mean, I would say that I'm more on the progressive and left-wing end of things politically. I'm one of those people that I want the Democratic Party to be more progressive, right? And it's interesting because in a way, I think people that are on that progressive end of things could probably learn a lot from the Schlaflys of the world, because I mean, the Phyllis Schlaflys, what they were able to do with the Republican Party is pretty, it's pretty wild. Like,
amazing.
They would go after their own. I mean, she went after Rockefeller Republicans. There is a contingent of the right that will attack the Republican Party in such a way that they can eventually take it over. And I don't know how progressives do that, and there may be obstacles to doing that within the Democratic Party. But I mean, the far right is amazing in its ability to, you know, create narratives about things like rhinos, Republicans in name only, and eventually just sort of ransack the party.
The one difference in the dynamic between the two parties is that the financial interests that exist inside the Republican Party are willing to utilize this, what you're talking about, this right-wing, you know, purity police, enforcer unit kind of conservatism. They're willing and able to utilize it in a way I think that is not possible in the Democratic Party. I don't think that progressives will ever say, to achieve our goal, we are willing to make a deal with Wall Street, and Wall Street is willing to let us run wild so long as we give them all of the supply side goodies they want. That's the inherent bargain inside the Republican Party that I think cannot be replicated. As a matter of fact, I think the progressive movement is a rejection of the Democratic Party's version of making a deal with Wall Street which is what the Democratic Leadership Council and Bill Clinton's presidency was all about, and which is what you see in the reaction right now inside the Democratic Party is against, with even with Biden, or why so many were upset and disappointed by Obama, because they do not want to cut the deal with Wall Street that conservatives are willing to do. And the fascinating thing inside the conservative movement is that it has evolved into a deal with what is essentially a prosperity gospel version of right-wing evangelicalism, so that they are all perfectly aligned, even though I guarantee you that there are people in the financial elite, if we want to call them that, or so the financialized industries, who have long supported supply-side economics, and who are even Milton Friedmanites and people who eventually became neocons, but a lot of the neoliberal economic establishment that has, you know, that the Clinton initiative of the coming out of the DLC was designed to try and peel off away from the Republican Party to help buttress their desire to hold power, that there is an incredible harmony there between on economics that I think unites them. And the people at the top are probably – they're not hardliners on abortion, and they're not hardliners on gay rights and these things. But they, because they have money, can buy themselves exemptions to the social war agenda that is being pushed by the people they are in bed with. And it's a difficult thing to overcome, and I don't think it's a thing that could be replicated on the left, because the progressive movement itself is one that's rejecting financialization, supply side economics, and Wall Street as a principle, at least in as far as Bernie Sanders goes, right? And the people around Bernie Sanders, I think that's where Elizabeth Warren was trying to be, is like, well, I'm a capitalist, but I just want to get back to modulated capitalism, which is FDR's solution. And maybe that's part of why the FDR identity as a hero has not maybe meshed completely with Bernie Sanders, because I think Barton Bernstein was a great historian. He was at Stanford for many years, a traditional sort of pre-World War II left-wing historian. And famously, if you know anything about Barton Bernstein, it's probably because he was assigned the task of writing the Enola Gay narrative for the Smithsonian. And Barton Bernstein is of a mind, of which I am too, as somebody whose graduate work was on Japanese fascism and World War II. He's of a mind that the bombs were dropped not to end the war, but as a demonstration of America's post-war order that it wanted to implement. And so his work was rejected by the Smithsonian, became a big controversy. And Barton Bernstein, my mentor was a student of Barton Bernstein, and my mentor, the great Tom O'Neill, likes to regale me with the story. It's a wonderful one. But he says, you know, Barton Bernstein hated FDR because he said FDR made the mistake of saving capitalism when it was on its last legs. And so that's another one of those push and pulls, is are you willing to save capitalism with a form of demand-side Keynesianism and rapid restrictions, or do you just want to excise capitalism? And so if your agenda is to end capitalism, I think you can't replicate necessarily what the Republican Party was able to replicate, or the activists inside the Republican Party, who in many ways the culture war shock troops are in a sense agents of the financial establishment that backs them. And just to finish this off, look no further than the Tea Party, which arises at the very end of George W. Bush's administration, initially in response to the financial crisis and the bailout, and then the Koch brothers and big Republican financial backers come in and turn the Tea Party into its shock troop inside the Republican Party, like the Schlafly Organization, another wave of purity enforcement inside the Republican Party to continue to push.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
To push out moderates who have done what have in the last two in the last election cycle in 2018 and now in this election cycle are doing what? Are coalescing inside the Democratic Party, being pushed over to the Democratic Party, shifting that, which I think then kind of – I think, you know, for the path forward for progressives in a way is to peel off and start another party.
I was going to say it's interesting since we were talking about Schlafly and we earlier talked about Buchanan. You know, there's this idea that they were completely against the quote-unquote rhinos in the party, the Republicans in name only, the moderate Republicans. But, I don't know if this is true of Schlafly, but I know it's true of Pat Buchanan. Pat Buchanan would go on rants on MSNBC saying, oh, John McCain, Mitt Romney, these horrible moderate Republicans, they don't go far enough. But then when the election would come up and it'd be like 2 weeks before the election with Obama, he would say, vote for Romney, vote for McCain. Yep.
Yes. Yeah. That's the thing. I guess that's a very simple way of summing up my very long circuitous soliloquy there. I called it a soliloquy. It wasn't a soliloquy. That's giving it too much credit. Is that when push comes to shove, they want to win. And when push comes to shove, I think inside the progressive movement in the Democratic Party, they want to be right. They want to be correct. They want to be on what they think is the right side of the issue.
And, I don't think that's always true. Let me put it this way.
Right now, I think that's the feeling inside for young people, for Bernie supporters inside the progressive movement. They're not. It's like to compromise just to win. You know, I think it's a bitter pill to swallow.
That's traditionally been what progressives and have done.
Yes.
I mean, we always end up being told at the last minute, do you want the opposition to win? They're worse. And I get the vote blue no matter who mentality. I understand that. I think we're in a very dangerous time. If Ginsburg passes away, I think that will be a very big issue if Trump is still in office. At the same time, I'm also getting where some progressives are coming from with this whole Dem exit thing, because when you've had Hillary Clinton saying, if you don't like the way the party is, just leave. You have Biden telling immigration reform activists, go vote for Trump if you're so critical of Obama's policy record. He's told anti-fracking people, go vote for someone else. Well, I mean, now we're being told, no, you have to vote for Biden. We need the progressives to vote for Biden. Meanwhile, a month ago, I was being told that Democrats just could coast on the white suburban embarrassed by Trump vote. I mean, it feels like gaslighting to me in a way. It's very frustrating.
It might be a little bit of – there might be some agenda of gaslighting, but I think some of it is actually just sort of demographic reality that the – you know, Trump is not a sustainable demographic – Trumpism is not a sustainable demographic movement going forward, right, because of these shifts. And I think that for the Democratic Party, which since Bill Clinton – has really been a center party, not even center left. And
I think it's a center right party in a lot of ways.
Okay, so center right. I mean, I'm not even actually that opposed to that either. So I think that it creates this incredible space on the other side, and I think it's not coincidental that Bernie Sanders is himself not a registered Democrat. And these dynamics inside the Democratic Party, I think, do not make it amenable, or the dynamics inside American politics, where you got to have – look, there are three centers of power in American life, the defense industry, the oil industry, and Wall Street. That's it. And when my explanation of the deep state, which I've gotten into many times and I've written 19,000 words on and whatnot, is that if you look, take a Venn diagram of oil, defense, and finance, or Wall Street, at the center of that Venn diagram is the deep state. That's the intersection. And that has been the source of the center of American power since Truman became president and then signed NSC 68, right? And it's the core of the national security state. It's the and it, it's not a you don't find the deep state in cubicles at Foggy Bottom or cubicles at the George Herbert Walker Bush Center for Intelligence, CIA headquarters in Langley. You find it in boardrooms and golf courses where decisions are really made, right? In country clubs and whatnot, where people intersect. You find it at the revolving door between business and government, right? People who move back and forth between these industries, between finance and the SEC and Treasury, people who move between the defense industry and the Pentagon and the Defense Department, people who move between the oil industry, and usually they go – sometimes they become Secretary of State like James Baker, right? So – or president. So because the oil industry has been so such an important part of that. The need to make that compact with these moneyed centers of power is not something that is available to the progressive movement as it stands today.
I wanted to add really quickly to when I say gaslighting, there's a specific reason I said it feels like gaslighting, because I don't know if there's a conscious agenda of gaslighting. Okay. I just it's really frustrating. Being told, we don't need you. Get out of the party, you progressives. And then on the other hand, at the last moment, being told, well, we need you now.
Yeah, I mean, vote or else abortion will be illegal next week, right? Because of the Supreme Court, for example. I think it's some of that is a reflection of the To finish the explanation a little bit, there's just the Democrats have made their peace and their deals with Wall Street over the course of the last 30 years. The Republicans have been doing it forever. The Republicans are, willing. The shock troops are willing to get in because their culture war is so existential. I think also because it's religiously based and often, I think makes them more available for that. But I think for progressives, it's, this next election, after this next election, there's going to be maybe a decision point. It's pretty obvious to me. So I felt early on that Bernie Sanders' juice inside the Democratic Party was being overestimated and overstated. And in the first two – in Iowa and then in New Hampshire – Iowa, was it a win or not? And then, there was all that confusion there. But then came New Hampshire. And when three out of four primary voters picked somebody other than Bernie Sanders in New Hampshire, a neighboring state for him, after 4 years of him basically being able to run a campaign mostly unopposed with 100% name recognition, and the fact that three out of four Democrats in that primary chose somebody else, said to me, that's three out of four, that's 25% of a party, that's 28% of America.
And the thing was, he was running against multiple moderates. At some point, it was going to get to the point where the moderates were going to consolidate around one moderate.
Exactly. And not just that, it's still, if his message was resonating, it wouldn't have mattered how many people were running, because he had a standalone message. It even stood alone in many ways from Elizabeth Warren's message, right? Because I think that I don't know how much they shared voters. I think there was obviously there's an abutment there, and there is some sharing, but not as strongly, because I think Warren was somebody who is not rejecting capitalism. She wanted to modulate it, and for other reasons. So that says to me that it's a smaller chunk, and it also is indicative of the extent to which Donald Trump's dynamic in the short term is successful, but in the long term, what he's doing is he's maybe seeding some of those McCain Romney people that you were talking about, who, when push comes to shove, the radicals and the McCain moderate people come together and say, okay, yeah, we'll do it. I think the Democratic Party is absorbing more of them now and will continue to absorb more of them. And so if they were a center party, as I called, new center right, they're really becoming the Rockefeller Republican Party, right? And when, you know, Rockefeller Republicanism, people forget that Griswold versus Connecticut, which is the famous Supreme Court case that set in motion the idea that reproductive rights were a privacy issue. It was a birth control issue. Griswold versus Connecticut. One of the sponsors of that was Prescott Bush, Senator Prescott Bush of Connecticut. Fundraisers for Planned Parenthood in Houston in the early 70s, two of the most successful fundraisers were George Herbert Walker Bush and Barbara Bush. And so that kind of idea, which has been built into moderate Republicanism after World War II, is still kind of latent in there, and I think makes a natural match to create the Democrats as this center-center-right party going forward, which does what? Vacates a space on the other end. And Bernie Sanders, having not being a registered Democrat, is in a way trying to effect a takeover inside the inside the Democratic Party that would mirror the hard right takeover that you talked about with Phyllis Schlafly, but is not available to Bernie Sanders because it does not have the possibility of making peace and compromise with the fundamental financially motivated centers of power inside the party.
I think that's a fair assessment. There's a lot more we could get into, but there's just one more thing I wanted to touch on real quickly.
Sure.
I was reading New York Magazine recently. They had a piece out entitled "Joe Biden Should Probably Just Hide Now." That's a very blunt way of putting it.
Right.
But it's interesting because you have people like James Carville, who I'm surprised he is still being trotted out because, well, I won't get into it. I don't want to be too ageist.
He really only won a couple times, and the other times he tried to win, like in Israel and stuff, as he was called in to save Ehud Barak or whatever, he kept failing. You mean like that? And the fact that he's also like a fossil, like
yeah. Well, that's what I'm getting at. Yeah, I was gonna use the term dinosaur, but
yeah.
So you have Carville, and also Clyburn came out and said we should cancel the primaries. Just let's get it over with. Let's shut this down. Biden is the guy. You know, just shut it down. Shut it down. Carville was saying the same thing. But what this New York Magazine article is saying rather bluntly is the reason we should shut this down is because it's not good to have Biden out there at this point. He doesn't do that great in the debates. And in a way, coronavirus may be a boon for the Biden campaign if this is the case.
Absolutely, because as long as he remains a more of an idea than a hard fact, as he just sort of represents the return to normal, as opposed to being out there. And but then again, you know, I think one of the things that Donald Trump has done is made it okay to say stupid shit and still get elected. So there is that. But yeah, I mean, this is the coronavirus is kind of – now we'll see. We're doing this – we're taping this on Sunday. The debate hasn't happened yet, folks. So we don't know if Bernie Sanders – you know, the Politico piece this morning was that Bernie Sanders' campaign is – it's all in on hoping that Joe Biden – you know, has a Hindenburg moment, Ode to Humanity in front of a national audience and implodes.
I mean, can I be honest? I don't even know if Sanders is looking to win the election anymore, the primary.
Well,
I think he really just wants to push Medicare for All in a debate.
Yeah, probably. And this would fit in with the BuzzFeed news article. And what I was saying is that he is more committed to his ideas than even to winning, right? And that's what makes him both admirable and attractive to people, but also makes him limited as a political operative inside this system that has been designed to reward people who compromise their values.
I was going to say, final thing here that I was going to get in, if we could, is, so you have Carville and Clyburn saying, yeah, shut these elections down. There's a lot of concern that Biden's going to have issues campaigning. At the same time, you have Nancy Pelosi coming out and saying, I don't want Bernie to drop out right now. He needs to stay in it. It's good that we have passionate grassroots supporters. And I recall what you said the last time you were on about Pelosi actually being a pretty smart operator. Yeah. I think she's right in this case. Yeah. I don't think it would be good if he dropped out. I don't think they should continue to alienate Bernie supporters. Even a person like Matthew Iglesias, who I'm not a big fan of, Iglesias was saying after South Carolina and after Super Tuesday, he came out and said, why are all you Democrats saying, you know, oh, screw the youth, we don't need him anyways? Iglesias was like, this is the future of the party. We can't completely, like,
yep,
tell them to screw off. I believe Jonathan Chait is also pointing that out. And I think Pelosi's aware of it.
Absolutely.
I think Pelosi is very aware that this is, like, a bad situation for the future of the Democrats.
I think actually Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has been kind of echoing a little bit of that. She's been much less hard line over the last couple weeks about the campaign than a lot of the activists. And I look, Pelosi is they say that she's a vote counter, right? That's how she's gotten where she's gotten, is being able to look at all of the different facts inside the Democratic Party, corral the cats, get them counted, and make sure that she has the votes to get from point A to point B for anything, which makes her not an ideologue who has a set of principles that she's holding fast to, but somebody who does what? Finds ways of creating compromise, because that's what the system rewards. We may not like the system. You may not like the way the system rewards those who compromise their values to get things done, or to get their aims met. But that's the way the system is designed right now. So, and has been since its inception in many ways.
But what I'm saying is, I think Pelosi may have the foresight to recognize that if you continue alienating progressives enough, and especially like young people, you know, and say things like Biden said, where I don't feel anything for millennials, it's all their fault.
Yeah.
I think she realizes that, like, that this will have ramifications potentially. I won't say definitively, but potentially 10 years down the road.
So, kind of like what I was postulating, which is the next – if Bernie Sanders has another act in his drama, it would be to spin off and establish a Democratic Socialist Party in America. And young people who are highly activated and are idealistic and in search of common good solutions over the primacy of the individual – every person for themselves, maybe the only route left is to vacate the Democratic Party, because you cannot hijack it from within, and you can't make the same deals that the radicals inside the Republican Party have been able to make with
you don't even money. Think it's possible to get inside the Democratic Party, maybe on state or local levels, I mean, rather than the presidency?
Well, that would be way more effective.
And, I mean, it would take a lot more time, though, too.
And that is such a great point, because the Phyllis Schlafly's of the world, do you know what they targeted at the beginning of the revolution? School boards. They took over school boards. Evangelicals and the Christian Coalition that came out of Pat Robertson's run in 1988 in Iowa, where he came in second or something in the caucus. That gave birth to a drive to take over school boards. And then once they took over school boards, they took over, you know, planning commissions. And then they took over state houses. And they built their way up. And they were willing over time to do this. Whereas the progressive movement is trying to get a quick fix. Let's just get a president. And actually, I think a president is the least effective way of transforming a country right now. The more effective way is the bottom-up approach, and you start at the school board level.
It's funny, I hear there's certain people in the Howie Hawkins campaign, the Green Party.
Yeah.
And I think he's also working with another party now. I think there's going to be like a joint Green Party socialist ticket. What's that?
Is it the Peace and Freedom that he's working with, or...
Yeah, I think there's a socialist party that's also they're going to run on like a joint thing. Like the Green Party and the Socialist Party are running with Hawkins. It's interesting because I know some people are trying to push Hawkins, and I know that Hawkins himself is really open to maybe reorganizing the Green Party in a lot of ways. But a lot of people are pushing Hawkins to use his presidential run for the Green Party to promote local elections for Greens in places where Greens may have like a slight chance of getting someone into a local seat.
That is the way to do it. And I think that this is, you know, people tell me over and over again, you know, a third party will never work in America. And that's because you're trying to do it all in one fell swoop with a presidential election. And that's actually not how you do it. You do it from the bottom up. You do it from the grassroots political level up, the state and local level up. And I think one of the reasons why Clyburn came out and made his statement endorsement of Biden, and why the moderates so quickly coalesced behind Joe Biden, is because Joe Biden is more likely at the top of the ticket to protect the Democrats' control of the House than Bernie Sanders. And so power actually runs from the top downward in a funny kind of way, or from the bottom up, I should say, because the people in the House and in down ballot elections, when they look at the top of the ticket, they want to know, is that person going to drive my voter or my opponent's voter? And for the three dozen House seats that or more that were flipped from Trump districts to the Democrats in 2018, how many of those are actually the white suburban voters that you referenced earlier, who the Democrats say, well, we can build a coalition between white suburban voters and African Americans, and we can win on that. We don't need the young progressives. That's actually how people in the House stay in power. So there's a self-interest of keeping all of the other levels of power in place. And it's reflected in the president that they would like to see at the top of the ticket, because it's going to help them get elected. And that's one of the reasons why building from the bottom up is such an effective way of holding on to power. And it's one of the ways in which the Republicans have done it, and has not been replicated by activists on the left.
The only thing I'll add to that is I keep recalling how, you know, the Bernie campaign had plans for if he became president. They had like over 100 executive orders that they were going to use already in place. And I think in some ways, all of us, left, right, center, we've all become too accustomed to the sort of executive domination.
Yes.
Since George W. Bush.
Yes. I could not agree more. I think if this country is going to evolve, it's going to be by returning to the primacy of Congress over the presidency. The unitary executive – this is – I mean, talk about mistakes. Obama made the mistake. I understand why, because he had a recalcitrant Mitch McConnell in the Senate of just continuing the tradition of building up the unitary executive, which is an outgrowth of the imperial presidency, or is a subset of the imperial presidency. And the idea that the president is the most important political player in American life is dangerous, and has been repeatedly dangerous. Really, you know, that small D idea of democracy, which is at the core of Bernie Sanders' vision of social democracy, and is replicated, I think, more effectively in parliamentary systems than our system, but it is not unavailable to the American governmental system. It just requires getting involved in re-promoting the role of the Congress and particularly the House of Representatives as the driving force in American politics. And that's going to take a different form of organizing and a different form of political outreach that doesn't try and win everything with one home run, but a couple – how about a walk, a couple opposite field hits, maybe an occasional double, and you build a rally and you score a lot of runs, and that versus the home run, I think, is a much more effective way in the long term. And it's actually the only way that this country is going to right itself, is because the country is so vast now that to have a referendum on one individual as a reflection of the zeitgeist of the people is just going to continue to lead to stark divisions that leave America continually divided and ultimately conquered.
Well, JP, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views. You know, I usually say that I like to end on a positive note, but I don't think we talked about it enough in this episode. I think coronapocalypse is something we should be very concerned about. I don't mean the idea that everyone's going to die, but I think a lot of people are not taking this seriously enough, at least like the general population. I still know people that don't think this is like a serious issue. And even if you're a healthy person, this seems like it is more serious than we realized, even for healthy people.
I couldn't agree more. There is a fork in the road on the way to the human future that we are at, and I don't think that we're understanding that there are decisions being made and forms of government and ways of dealing with these kinds of issues that are going to have implications for a long time. Before we came on, I saw that Spain had a massive spike over the last 24 hours in not only cases but deaths. And one of the scenes I saw was that the Spanish police are using drones to fly around the city and tell people to please go back into your homes. We're in a weird moment, and there are a lot of dystopian possibilities that can be coming in the future, and how we deal with this and whether we choose the common good over the individual or the individual over the common good is going to be determinative of how we deal with other larger issues like climate change and other massive ecological dislocations that are coming, and refugee, climate migrations. This is in a way, it's almost a test case scenario for how we're going to cope with the larger challenges that are coming over the next decade or two.
Weren't you telling me, too, that in regards to some of the science on coronavirus, like even if you're healthy and you survive it, like you're diminished in a lot of ways?
Yeah, they're finding this was, I believe it was Hong Kong. A study, scientists were showing that even for people who were recovering, there was maybe 30-40% lung capacity loss for many survivors, people who recovered. A really interesting thread by a Harvard PhD scientist showing how there are interesting aspects of COVID-19 where it seems to be attacking people who are diabetic and the way that they process blood sugar. All we know is right now symptomology and death rates. Over the course of the next 16 to 18 months, we're going to get a lot of data on longer impacts to things like heart muscles, which is another thing that I've seen pop up in a number of stories, is that it may be damaging a heart muscle over a long time. So we don't know yet. And this is COVID-19. That means that there were other COVIDs before. This is 19.
Wasn't SARS a coronavirus?
Yes. So coronaviruses are on a little bit of a run right now. And I don't expect the run to end. And the way in which that we as human beings are interacting with the natural world, and I don't want to get into just, Chinese wet markets and their open air meat markets and, places where civet cats are next to birds and civet cats get eaten and for whatever medicinal powers, and then all of a sudden SARS pops up and all this kind of stuff, and then we don't know if it's pangolins and bats. But there's a whole nother side of it in the West, where every year it's the warnings keep coming about superbugs and superbugs and the way that we have to use massive amounts of antibiotics to keep animals in these giant factory farming conditions that are producing super resistant bacteria, and we're running out of antibiotics. And, you know, we're playing with roulette. We're playing roulette, Russian roulette, on a couple fronts here with the natural world. And that's why I say that in a way this is kind of a test case for how we even deal with things like climate change. Are we, you know, the Trump administration's response, as I mentioned earlier, developed was to try and buy away a vaccine from Russia, Germany, to try and have it exclusively.
You know what worries me about the vaccine is I've said to people, you know, can't they basically charge for the vaccines, the people who make the drugs? I mean, that worries me. I don't know. Maybe that's like off base.
Well, no. It's getting back to this issue of whether it's going to be a common good solution or an every person for themselves solution. And, you know, we talked about young people. I get wanting to be, you know, recalcitrant in the face of this, and it's boomer remover, and I'm going to go and have my St. Patty drinks, and I'm going to, you know, I'm not going to live my life afraid of this, particularly since I've been told that as a young person, I'm kind of exempt from it. But that's, you know, French scientists told Emmanuel Macron last week that the reason they should shut down the schools is because young people may be the Typhoid Marys of this, that they're the asymptomatic carriers that are spreading it to older people. I mean, at some point, we're going to have to decide, do we want to do this together or not? And in a weird way, this is our Independence Day moment, right? The idea behind wanting aliens to show up is that the only way mankind is ever going to come together as a unit and be and say we're all common, have a common goal, and that's to be human together in the face of an alien invader, right? Maybe this is it. Maybe this is the test run for that. Maybe this is us being put to the test. And how we deal with it, I think, is going to be indicative of how we deal with things going forward, and maybe how well we or badly we deal with things that are right around the, not just right around the corner, they're right in front of our face.
Well, we're in a wilderness of mirrors, and I guess we have a lot of hard decisions to make, as you pointed out in this conversation. JP, thank you so much for coming on Parallax Views. Real quick, how can people read the rundown in News Vandal?
Just go to newsvandal.com. I'm posting there occasionally. I'm going to try and get back into writing a little bit more over the next couple weeks. When you go to newsvandal.com, it's spelled just like it sounds. A little box will pop up. Sign up for it. You can get the rundown. It comes 5 days a week. Key to the rundown is you just read the headlines in order. It's not there. Don't be daunted by all of the links. I never alter a headline, but the headlines are stacked to tell you the meta story of the news cycle. I have multiple categories. And then if you see something you like, click on it and read and check it out. But it's been a bear to do with the coronavirus, and obviously the coronavirus is dominating it, and it's a daunting amount of information, but I'm trying my best to get into the rundown, the storylines and the meta stories that give you the best snapshot of what's going on, because there's so much information out there, and hopefully I'm making some progress in coming up with something that's useful for people who read the rundown. And don't be surprised if you see stories from sources you don't agree with or that are contradictory to other stories. That's the whole point. I actually go out to different parts of the internet that you may not go to try and bring those back to you so that you can see the larger context.
Well, hey, thanks again, JP Satilli.
Take care.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. Please be sure to check out JP Satilli's work at newsvandal.com. JP's daily The Rundown, the collection of news stories from the day that he compiles, is especially useful if you're looking to keep track of current events and trends. As always, you can let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at @viewsparallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. If you can, please support me on Patreon, patreon.com/parallaxviews. Really could use your support, but I'm not going to push that too hard to close out this episode. We're living in very tense times. I think everyone is feeling that right now, and I just want everyone to stay safe. Wash your hands. 20 seconds. Remember, 20 seconds. Don't touch your face. Just play it safe. Be careful. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.